Thank you very much, and thank you for organizing this, and thank you for inviting me. Let me put my cards on the table from the outset. I'm the skeptic. I'm the money laundering skeptic. I view various aspects of the entire AML industry with skepticism, and I'm looking today at civil recovery, which is not the same as confiscation, is partly like Canadian civil forfeiture. And remember, this was the problem. Tony Blair, in even for him a slightly sanctimonious mode, it is simply not right in modern Britain, and he goes on. And so the Proceeds of Crime Act introduced the civil recovery procedure, which is an in rem procedure, powers to freeze and seize and all the rest of it, strong investigatory powers, and then ultimately a proprietary right to be conferred by the court, as in bankruptcy, on a trustee. So it's seizing property, and it's an in rem action. First thing, remember the Canadians partly call it civil forfeiture. Is it recovery? Is it civil? Well, it's not recovery in any sensible use of the word in the English language. And it's only civil after the exercise of considerable casuistry, as we shall see in due course. This is what recovery means. Recovery is when somebody takes your stuff and you go and get it back. And that's not what a civil recovery action is. The quotation is incidentally about some actions which, if performed tomorrow, would land David at The Hague on genocide charges. So why do we have it? Sometimes we have it to prevent criminals committing further crimes. And that applies, I think, in a case in which civil recovery does work well and in which the law pre-2003 was a mess, which is cash. Especially the magistrate's court's procedure is an eminently justifiable and good way of seizing it. Then people say, even some judges say, well, the criminal has no proper title to the property that they obtained by crime because they were doing something naughty to get it, they don't really own it. And the answer to that is, well, actually they do. English law says they do, and if it didn't, then there would be no reason to have the civil recovery procedure. Then there are people who claim that the state acquires some sort of proprietary right in this property. Again, you know, the law of personal property in England and Wales says no, it doesn't. Attorney General in Reading, Attorney General in Blake, and so on. Or there are people who say, well, it deters crime by removing the financial incentive to commit crime. I must say I'm skeptical of that sort of argument. The argument that the criminal commits the crime knowing that he or she will go to prison for X amount of time, but then will come out to the you know, pot of gold in the Cayman Islands or whatever it is. I think that ascribes far greater a degree of rational calculation, but also to the criminal, but also it's difficult to see how the criminal rationally calculating would arrive at that objective. And then there's the, wouldn't it be nice if anti-money laundering meta-narrative, which says, you know, there are these huge amounts of money swilling around the world, and if only we could get them all, then we could build schools and hospitals and finance the CPS and all the rest of it. And if we are not able to do it, then that's because we don't have enough power or we don't have enough resources, and we need that power and we need those resources. And whenever we fail, it's because we don't have that power and those resources, and you ought to furnish us with them. And then there's the Kantian approach, which is Blair's, that says it really is not right. And it doesn't matter how much money we recover. You know, it's nice if we recover money, but if you could do it at, well, nil net cost to the public purse, properly costed on a full economic cost basis, would you still do it? And the answer for Blair, I suspect, is he still would. And I think you can determine a lot about your attitude to the seizure of the proceeds of crime by looking at that question. Human rights issues arose, of course, and the principal one was in respect of Article 6, our civil recovery proceedings, criminal proceedings in disguise. There's a recent piece by Colin in Legal Studies that goes very nicely through all the ECR jurisprudence. I think so far as England, Wales and Northern Ireland are concerned, it was really knocked on the head in a case called Walsh in 2005. In the Court of Appeal for Northern Ireland, that was decided. What had happened before then was that there was a confiscation case on Article 6, and the then House of Lords had decided that Article 6.2 and Article 6.3 did not apply to confiscation proceedings, and that was adopted in the case of non-conviction-based civil recovery in this case called Walsh. Essentially, in McIntosh, Lord Bingham had given clear reasons why he wasn't talking about non-conviction-based recovery, and a fiddle took place because the judges in Walsh said, well, it does, because civil recovery is just like confiscation, whereas, of course, in confiscation, there has already been a conviction. I won't go through the whole of the judgment, but you can see from this what I'm going to do. Lord Bingham gives eight or nine reasons why he's not talking about civil recovery, and then those are kind of fudged when it comes to why he's not talking about civil recovery, and those are fudged when you get to Walsh and the actual civil recovery decision. In Walsh, an application for leave to appeal was refused, an ECHR appeal failed, and we have to accept, I think, that Article 6.2 and Article 6.3 are not going to apply in the case of civil recovery. The first protocol will not usually be a problem, as to a greater or lesser extent it has been in confiscation. This causes me to wonder what we're doing with the civil criminal distinction in the Human Rights Act. I wonder whether that hard and fast distinction is one we really need now. You know, Andrew Ashworth talks about the European Convention on Human Rights as having been written at a time when people had Morris Minors with windscreen wipers like this. And there were many things different at that time. And in particular, we hadn't developed the sort of regulation that we have now. In 1947, 48, 49, there were two state agencies which had power to fine. Only two. Well, there was a third one created in 1947. And so the human rights implications of regulations haven't been fitted in. What I think we need to avoid with the European Convention on Human Rights is getting into a situation like they have with the United States Constitution, where it's too difficult to change it. And it's treated as this thing that you can't possibly depart from. You know, whether or not Mr. Cameron is successful in scrapping the Human Rights Act altogether, I do think we need to look at this and ask, you know, how would we redraw it tomorrow, and would we use the civil criminal distinction as an axiom, Or might we say, well, according to what somebody is threatened with losing, then they have a graduated series of rights, something like that. Because there are some civil law decisions that can affect people extremely seriously in a way sometimes that are far worse than sending them to prison for a long term. You know, would you rather go to prison for 20 years or lose your children? Well, a lot of people might say, well, I'd sooner go to prison. So you might want the rights fee. The second issue is that we were told there was going to be a human rights culture. And it's like tax payers writing tax legislation. Of course, the effect of the Human Rights Act was that legislators wrote legislation which they thought would not attract the protections of Article 6.2 and Article 6.3. They went through the pre-existing, and so we get control orders and we get ASBOs and we get lots of stuff. We get confiscation, we get the changes in taxation, simply to avoid the rights that you would get under Article 6.2 and Article 6.3. So I think that whatever else we do, I think we need to reconsider that distinction. What do you need proof of? Well, I mean, all this is going to be in the paper. I'm going to flick through this. Unaccounted wealth and lifestyle is probably the most important issue. In England and Wales, it's not usually a problem, because if you have unaccounted wealth, then you're usually going to be signing on and you're going to end up getting done for benefit fraud. If you know you're living in the palatial home with no easily visible signs of evidence. But lifestyle is admissible, and a great many things are admissible which would not be admissible at a criminal trial. If you look at this list, we have a criminal record from the long, long ago. We have police intelligence material. We have compromise of proceedings in Ireland. We have access to funds. We have previous bad behavior. We have hearsay evidence. You've got illegally obtained evidence will go on. You know, lots of things which the police people amongst you will be thinking, gosh, if only I could put those in criminal trials, wouldn't that be lovely? And I have to say, most of this works okay. I think the privilege against self-incrimination stuff in civil recovery probably works okay. The major problem that arose early was in respect of the right to legal representation. The whole basis of the Proceeds of Crime Act is that you're not supposed to be able to use the property, which is the subject matter of the claim, in order to defend the claim. And this gave rise to an early case called Squirrel, in which the defendant, who didn't have civil legal aid, because it's a civil action, because the courts have held it's a civil action, had no lawyer at all to defend a claim which was actually at least arguably, and one which I think he probably could have succeeded in defending. And so they had to put in place legislation which, to my mind, still doesn't give the defendant enough access to the funds, which are the subject matter of the application, to defend the application. Then the stuff about the institutional framework, you remember we started off with the Assets Recovery Agency, and then it went to SOCRA and then to NCEA and various other agencies. And ARA in particular was presented at that time, when it was abolished, which is 2007, as having been this tremendous blunder, because it became clear that they weren't actually seizing enough then, at that stage, to cover their own salaries. And this was regarded as a disgrace, and Grant Shapps went on about it, and there was a Public Accounts Committee report denouncing them. I'm not sure if it was. You know, if you go back to the beginning, if you're Tony Blair, then it doesn't actually matter how much it costs, because it's wrong that these people have the money. But the changes were made. Now, apparently, the latest figures I have, I don't know if you have later or more detailed figures, say 48 million in 2012-13, which is including tax recovery. I mean, don't forget, if we move into tax, then everything is going to get two more zeros added on. Small investment that's worth £1,000 disappears. Everything is chicken feed as soon as tax is covered. And watch out for this recommended new offence of offshore tax evasion, because the revenue do not appear to have worked through the effects of money laundering law piggybacking on that new offence, which will be very serious. So was ARA that much of a failure? I don't really know. What I'd like to do, if I can make that come back, is really to leave you with some questions. And there are three, really. What's the constitutional significance of all of this? What I think it has done is changed the duty to explain oneself to the state. And that is a change of huge constitutional significance. We do now need now to justify to the state to a greater extent our possession of property. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think it's probably a good thing so long as there are appropriate safeguards for financial privacy. Second, what are the good areas and what are the bad areas for civil recovery? I think cash is a very good area for it. I think tax is a very bad area. And my own view is that the criminal justice system has gone too far into tax already, and we're in danger of generating a situation where there's really only one criminal offence left, and that will be laundering the proceeds of tax evasion, because almost any property offence could be charged as that. And lastly, the Blair question. Would it be a good policy? You know, if you could have a properly costed net break even, would you still want to do it or not? Because I think that determines fundamentally what your view is of proceeds of crime law. So I will stop there. Thank you.